the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and streaming at kboo.fm. That was Clayton Morgridge singing the Old Mole Variety Hour theme song. We're still mourning Clayton's passing last month and remembering and honoring his many decades of work and labor for the Old Mole Variety Hour, tremendous contributions he's made over the years. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Today we're focusing on how repeatedly in the past and present and all places in the world, ordinary people rise up to make radical change. With Bernie Sanders' sweep of Democratic primaries, we find a glimmer of hope in how on-the-ground organizing and the dreams of people for a more compassionate and just future can stand up to power and corruption. But the powerful are mobilizing to discredit those visions, and today we look at examples from the past and present on how to push back. First, Desiree Helligers interviews Dr. Melanie Plout, MD and co-lead of the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX, about recent developments in the fight to stop the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and about the trial of the Zenith 5 beginning Monday. Next, Bill Resnick introduces Sharon Grant, who reads from Nicole Hannah Jones' important essay from the 1619 Project, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written, Black Americans Fought to Make It True." The essay demonstrates that the Black struggle for liberty and democracy had crucial impacts on the development of the U.S. political system, greatly democratizing this country, though always furiously opposed by conservative interests. There's a long way to go to build a society that lives up to its ideals, especially for African Americans who led the struggle. Finally, I'll speak to Tracy Francis, director of the Cascade Festival of African Films, which winds up this week with films devoted to women filmmakers. Now, here's the Moles, Desiree Helligers, and Dr. Melanie Plout of the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX.
So before we get going this morning, I just want to put out a quick call to action and solidarity with our brothers and sisters who are being picked up by ICE. Hector Canedo Sanchez, who teaches at the Bridger K-8 school in Portland's Montevilla neighborhood and is the father of a seven-year-old child, is facing the prospect of deportation, as is Irene, no last name given, who was detained by ICE agents on February 18th. All three of her children are profoundly deaf and communicate with ASL. And so there's a call to ask that people contact Wyden and Merkley, as well as Governor Brown, to demand ICE out of Oregon and ask them to reach out to the mayor, ask our listeners to reach out to Mayor Wheeler and ask him why we are deporting teachers, mothers, and children in a sanctuary city. Ask all of these elected officials to please put pressure on ICE for the immediate release of Hector and Irene. So my guest this morning is Dr. Melanie Plout. She's the co-lead for the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX. Thank you for joining us this morning, Dr. Plout.
My pleasure.
Okay, can you fill us in a little bit on the latest with respect to the Federal Regulatory Commission, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's decision on Thursday, or non-decision on Thursday, kind of a delayed decision, and its significance with respect to the movement to stop Jordan Cove?
Yes, well, this has been really a week of good news for everyone who's been fighting this fossil fuel project for the last decade and a half. There are two huge blows. One was the FERC decision that you mentioned, and the other was the decision by the Department of Land Conservation and Development about the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Plan. So the project isn't dead yet, but this was a very good week for our battle against the Canadian company, which wants to build a 220-mile pipeline through four counties, crossing 400 waterways. That would be the largest greenhouse gas emitter in Oregon. So FERC, which is the federal regulatory agency, had rejected this project back in 2016 because of the harm that it would do to landowners and a failure of need. Of course, it was revived, as you probably know, after the election of Trump. But in the past 3 years, there have been tens of thousands of comments written to state, local, and federal agencies opposing this project. There have been rallies, sit-ins, arrests, creative art, testimony, multiple phone calls. And in the past year, we've seen some success. The state agencies have developed a backbone. And in May of 2019, they declined to give Pembina a clean water permit. And interestingly enough, Pembina never reapplied for this permit. Then, last month, the Department of State Lands refused to issue an extension for a what's called the fill removal permit, which is anytime you dig in a river or an estuary, you have to get this permit. They declined to give an extension, and Pembina withdrew their application. So prior to this past week, the Pembina had lost two battles with the state agencies, and then last Wednesday, they lost a third critical state permit, which is the DLCD, said that what Pembina wanted to do was not consistent with the Oregon Coastal Management Plan. Probably partly as a result of this decision, we had the rather surprising outcome at FERC the following day. FERC is usually a rubber stamp for gas pipelines. And as we started to listen to the hearing, we thought it was going to be, as it had been in the past, another rubber stamp. The first person who spoke was Chatterjee. He's the chair of the committee, and he, as expected, said, oh yes, Pembina is great. And then the second person, the one Democrat, said, no, this is a bad project. And then, surprisingly enough, Bernard McNamee, who is the third member of the committee, said, I haven't had enough time to digest what the state of Oregon is telling us, so my vote is a nay for now. Clearly, this is not a denial, but it's a very good step in the right direction that somebody actually cares to hear what the state of Oregon has to say.
Okay, and I think Bernard McNamee is probably going to release his position this week.
We expect that he will, although there's no absolute guarantee of that. Now, even if, as expected, he does say that the project should go ahead, this does not mean that it can go ahead. Any approval by FERC would be a conditional approval, and it would be conditioned on the state permits. Now, there could be efforts by the company and the federal government to try to overrule what the state has said, but they cannot do that. And any attempts that they made to do that would end up probably with years in court. So we are moderately optimistic that Pembina may see the handwriting on the wall and withdraw their application. In fact, something akin to that just happened back east. There's a Constitution pipeline that a company called Williams wanted to build, another gas pipeline, and they had been pressing for this not quite as long as we've been fighting Jordan Cove, but it's been 8 years that they wanted to build it, and it was the same thing. FERC had approved it, but the state regulators had said, no, your plan to cross our waterways does not protect our state, and so just a couple days ago, that plan was withdrawn. So we would be delighted, of course, if FERC disapproved or denied the permit for Jordan Cove. But even if they go ahead with it, there's still really, Pembina has very much an uphill battle to get this approved. I think we should be optimistic and we should be very pleased with our state agencies.
Okay. And I mean, recently, just this past week on February 12th, The Intercept did a really illuminating article about Pembina's involvement with the North Bend, Oregon Sheriff's Department and law enforcement there. It was harkening back to a November 2018 event that was organized by the National Sheriff's Association and that focused on training dozens of law enforcement officers and corporate security personnel on how to wage propaganda battles against protesters. And we're also hearing about, you know, certainly involvement in kind of comprehensive surveillance of activists. So, you know, plenty of evidence to suggest both that Pembina is an incredibly bad corporate actor and also that they are basically buying off local law enforcement or attempting to do so.
Yes, absolutely. They had funded five positions in the local Coos Sheriff's Department, although recently, as they pulled back some of their monies that they were using to try to bribe the local officials to support them, they pulled the funding for those five positions. So again, that was a good sign. But yes, we're seeing this all over the country, attempts to make it illegal to protest against fossil fuel. In a way, I see it as a sign of our strength because we have been so successful in stopping projects that they are trying to up their game. But we're gonna win this one.
Okay, well, maybe it's a good thing for us to kind of turn our attention to the trial that's beginning this morning of the protesters against the Zenith Pembina liquid natural gas export terminal in Portland.
Yeah, Zenith is an interesting case where they have found a hole in what we call the thin green line, where we are able to prevent the export of the fossil fuels, which mostly come from the inland west, over to the big markets in Asia. Zenith was able to burrow through the line by taking over an old asphalt terminal. And so they didn't need new permits. It's kind of a glitch in how our permitting system works that even though this was a completely different use from the asphalt terminal, they were able to operate and even to expand under some old building permits. So we've been trying every trick in the book to stop Zenith. We have had multiple testimonies at City Hall. We've had rallies. And last spring, a group of protesters twice put a little house and built a lovely garden on the tracks at Zenith. And some of those who were arrested are probably, as we speak right now, in the courtroom at the Multnomah County Courthouse. I believe it's room 526. There's going to be jury selection today, but the really interesting stuff will probably happen tomorrow and Wednesday if anybody wants to come. This is a really landmark trial because it's the first time that's what's called the necessity defense has been allowed in Oregon. And the necessity defense says that we did something wrong, but it was the lesser of two evils. It's like breaking somebody's door because their house was on fire. We had to do this because we had no other option to try to save the planet.
Okay, yeah, and I just want to refer our listeners also to the documentary film made by Old Moles, Jan Hocken. Her film is called Necessity, and it's really following the attempts to use the necessity defense in fossil fuel organizing and resistance.
Yes, yes. And there's going to be another trial beginning of May for the valve turner, Ken Ward, up near Bellingham, for those who are particularly interested in this issue. If you are interested in taking action on Zenith, There is a way we are trying to intervene right now at a regulatory level, which is Zenith will come up for its clean air permit in a few months. And part of that is the city has to say that it is compatible with how we want the city to be using our land. It's called the Land Use Compatibility Statement. And we are asking the city to stand up firmly and say, no, Zenith is not compatible. So if you are interested in taking an action on Zenith, you could call Mayor Wheeler or Commissioner Udaly Fritz or Hardesty and let them know that please tell Zenith that their action is not compatible with how we want the land in our city used.
Okay, and are there any, is there any sense of the likelihood of the necessity defense flying in an Oregon courtroom at this point?
People think that, you know, and I'm not an expert in this, but people do think that there is some possibility that juries in Multnomah County, which is a relatively progressive place, may be sympathetic to this argument because we have more probably knowledge about the state of the climate here in the city of Portland or in the county of Multnomah than we do in other places. So there are some other fossil fuel fights that I just want to be sure people have on their radar. Some things never seem to die. One of them is there is a methanol plant that a company wants to build up in Kalama. And Kalama, as you know, is just only less than an hour from here. It's right on our Columbia River. And this methanol plant would be taking fracked gas and turning it into a liquid called methanol, which could be shipped to China. Now, the company has claimed that this fuel would replace coal in the manufacture of plastics in China. But we know a couple of things. Number one, there's no way that we can be guaranteed that it would displace coal. And number two, the company told its investors that it was going to use this substance, methanol, as a fuel, which means that the greenhouse gas footprint of this plant is even worse than what the company has been trying to say to the regulators. In fact, I believe Columbia River Keepers has sued the company for fraud in respect to its investors. So some very interesting happenings up with the fight against the methanol plant in Kalama. Right now, from the regulatory point of view, it's in the hands of Ecology, which is kind of like DEQ here in Oregon. So if anyone wants to call Ecology and say, please, no fracked gas to methanol, to plastics, or fuel in our Columbia River watershed, that would be great. And then one other thing for people to keep on their radar is global partners. So this is a little bit like Zenith because it's the use of an existing facility that has permits to try to, again, take oil trains, just like in Zenith, the tar sands from Alberta, and send it overseas. In this case, they're using a terminal which has been approved for ethanol, which is much cleaner than, you know, the tar sands are the most carbon intensive form of energy in the world. And they are the worst for the global environment, and they are also terrible for the place where the boreal forest has to be destroyed in order to scrape the tar sands out of the earth. So global partners, if it were to be turned into an oil terminal, would be an even larger export terminal than Zenith. And it's only a little bit further away from us. Sadly, there just isn't the publicity about it up in Columbia County, and I think we have a responsibility as activists in Portland to pay attention to global partners, which in many ways is even more evil than Zenith.
And this maybe also kind of highlights some of the intersections between kind of the fights to preserve some kind of social safety net and the fossil fuel struggle, because communities that have, you know, are stripped of unemployment, healthcare, livable or strong schools, all of those kinds of important pieces of the social fabric are far more likely to be vulnerable to arguments for bringing in fossil fuel infrastructure. And it's certainly clear that the amount of energy that that fighting these fossil fuel terminals is consuming is taking away from the capacity of communities to begin to address and bring in more sustainable forms of energy.
Yes, absolutely. We know that the fossil fuel companies target what they consider economically depressed regions because those people don't have other options and because there isn't the population base there to fight it as effectively. So once again, I would just say that we in Portland have a responsibility, as I think we have done with Jordan Cove. We've really mobilized very heavily to try to protect the people in Coos County. We have a responsibility to do the same up in Kalama and in Columbia County where they want to build the Global Partners plant.
And just a heads up also that Barbara Bernstein on Locust Focus at 10 is really going to be honing in on the most recent developments in the Jordan Cove struggle. So my guest today has been Dr. Melanie Plout, co-lead of the Fossil Fuel Resistance Team at 350 PDX. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
You are listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Lori Mercier. We just heard from Desiree Helligers and Dr. Melanie Plout of 350 PDX. And coming up next, Bill Resnick introduces Sharon Grant, who reads from Nicole Hannah-Jones' important essay from the 1619 Project, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans fought to make it true."
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here with Sharon Grant. Last week, Monday, we introduced you to an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones titled, "Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Have Fought to Make Them True." The essay is one part of a New York Times project written by its black journalists, also other people of color, and even some white journalists. The project is called 1619. It traces the black experience in the territory that became the United States from the landing of the first 20-some slaves in Jamestown, Virginia in 1619, almost exactly 400 years ago. I did the introductions, and Sharon Grant did the dramatic reading of excerpts from the essay. Sharon Grant's an Afro-American woman from Brooklyn and Chicago, has most spent more time, though, in Portland, worked as a health educator for Multnomah County for 20 years. She's also an accomplished singer and also contributed her voice as the omniscient narrator in several documentary films. The essay started with Nicole Hannah-Jones' family, their experience of brutal slavery, then along with millions of black, mostly sharecroppers, led by a woman called Grandmama, they migrated to the North in the 1940s to Waterloo, Iowa, to settle in a black ghetto across the river from the white side, in a town where the only jobs available for black women were as white housekeepers, and for men, manual jobs when labor was needed. Her family lived very poor, but through all of that, her father, who could never get a steady living wage job but worked himself to the bone, carefully flew and carefully tended an American flag, which mystified the young Nicole Hannah-Jones. Through the essay, we come to understand why her father was flying the flag. Sharon Grant, you have already read last week Nicole Hannah-Jones' portrait of slavery and the U.S. Constitution, its Declaration of Independence, its many passages that commit the country to freedom and democracy, indeed inalienable rights for all men. Yet the Constitution contains, at least in six provisions, it had the effect of treating black slaves as property that could be bought, sold, and disposed of like farm animals. Sharon Grant, let's start.
So, Bill, we're now in the essay with Nicole Hannah-Jones' discussion of Lincoln and the Civil War. On August 14, 1862, a mere 5 years after the nation's highest courts declared that no black person could be an American citizen, President Abraham Lincoln called a group of five esteemed free black men to the White House for a meeting. The Civil War had been raging for more than a year, and black abolitionists, who had been increasingly pressuring Lincoln to end slavery, must have felt a sense of great anticipation and pride. The war was not going well for Lincoln. Britain was contemplating whether to intervene on the Confederacy's behalf, and Lincoln, unable to draw enough new white volunteers for the war, was forced to reconsider his opposition to allowing black Americans to fight for their own liberation. The president was weighing a proclamation that threatened to emancipate all enslaved people in the states that had seceded from the Union if the states did not end the rebellion. The proclamation would also allow the formerly enslaved to join the Union Army and fight against their former masters. But Lincoln worried about what the consequences of this radical step would be. Like many white Americans, he opposed slavery as a cruel system at odds with American ideals, but he also opposed black equality. He believed that free black people were a troublesome presence, incompatible with a democracy intended only for white people. Quote, free them and make them politically and socially our equals, he had said 4 years earlier. My own feelings will not admit of this. And if mine would, we well know that those of the great mass of white people will not, end quote. That August day, as the men arrived at the White House, after exchanging a few niceties, Lincoln got right to it. He informed his guests that he had gotten Congress to appropriate funds to ship black people, once freed, to another country. Lincoln told them, you and we are different races. Your race suffer very greatly, many of them, by living among us, while ours suffer from your presence. In a word, we suffer on each side. You can imagine the heavy silence in that room as the weight of what the president said momentarily stole the breath of those five black men. It was 240 years to the month since the first of their ancestors had arrived on these shores before Lincoln's family, long before most of the white people insisting that this was not their country. The Union had not entered the war to end slavery, but to keep the South from splitting off. Yet black men had signed up to fight. Enslaved people were fleeing their forced labor camps, which we like to call plantations, trying to join the effort, serving as spies, sabotaging Confederates, taking up arms for his cause as well as their own. And now Lincoln was blaming them for the war. Quote, although many men engaged on either side do not care for you one way or the other, without the institution of slavery and the colored race as a basis, the war could not have an existence, the president told them. It is better for both of us, therefore, to be separated, end quote. As Lincoln closed the remarks, Edward Thomas, the delegation's chairman, informed the president, perhaps curtly, that they would consult on his proposition. Take your full time, Lincoln said. No hurry at all. Nearly 3 years after that White House meeting, General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox. By summer, the Civil War was over, and 4 million black Americans were suddenly free. Contrary to Lincoln's view, most were not inclined to leave, agreeing with the sentiment of a resolution against black colonization put forward at a convention of black leaders some decades before. Quote, this is our home, and this is our country. Beneath its sod lie the bones of our fathers. Here we were born, and here we will die, end quote.
We have walked through the shadows of death. We had to walk all by ourselves. We'll never been free.
That was Mavis Staples. Her song, We'll Never Turn Back, and this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, for the Old Mill Variety Hour with Sharon Grant, who is presenting excerpts from an essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones on Black struggle and its immense contribution to shape this country. So, Sharon, here we were born, and here we will die. Black state in the United States, and with abolitionists, made sure that the Union Army stayed in the South to protect former slaves, who were, of course, a majority of the population. They got organized to vote. So, Sharon, they accomplished a great deal in the short period that they stayed in power. Tell us about it.
Yes. As Nicole Hannah-Jones pointed out, they wrote the most egalitarian state constitutions the South had ever seen. More equitable tax legislation, laws that prohibited discrimination in public transportation, accommodation, and housing. Their biggest achievement was the establishment of that most democratic of American institutions, the public school. The freed slaves were, as Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote, the newly freed Black people who had been prohibited from learning to read and write during slavery and were desperate for an education. So Black legislators successfully pushed for a universal state-funded system of schools, not just for their own children, but for white children too. Black legislators also helped pass the first compulsory education laws in the region. Just 5 years into Reconstruction, every Southern state had enshrined the right to a public education for all children in its constitution. In some states, like Louisiana and South Carolina, small numbers of Black and white children briefly attended schools together. And the newly freed Blacks also made crucial gains nationally. Led by Black activists and a Republican Party pushed left by the blatant recalcitrance of white Southerners, the years directly after slavery saw the greatest expansion of human and civil rights this nation would ever see. In 1865, Congress passed the 13th Amendment, making the United States one of the last nations in the Americas to outlaw slavery. The following year, Black Americans pushed white legislators to pass the Civil Rights Act, the nation's first such law and one of the most expansive pieces of civil rights legislation Congress has ever passed. It codified Black American citizenship for the first time, prohibited housing discrimination and gave all Americans the right to buy and inherit property, make and enforce contracts, and seek redress from courts. In 1868, Congress ratified the 14th Amendment, ensuring citizenship to any person born in the United States. The 14th Amendment also, for the first time, constitutionally guaranteed equal protection under the law. Ever since, nearly all marginalized groups have used the 14th Amendment in their fights for equality, including the recent successful arguments before the Supreme Court on behalf of same-sex marriage. Finally, in 1870, Congress passed the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing the most critical aspect of democracy and citizenship, the right to vote, to all men, regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. For this fleeting moment, known as Reconstruction, the majority in Congress seemed to embrace the idea that out of the ashes of the Civil War, we could create a multiracial democracy that Black Americans envisioned, even if our founding fathers did not. But it would not last. And Nicole Hannah-Jones explains why. Because anti-Black racism runs in the very DNA of this country, as does the belief, so well articulated by Lincoln, that Black people are the obstacle to national unity. The many gains of Reconstruction were met with fierce white resistance throughout the South, including unthinkable violence against the formerly enslaved, wide-scale voter suppression, electoral fraud, and even, in some extreme cases, the overthrow of democratically elected biracial governments. Faced with this unrest, the federal government decided that Black people were the cause of the problem, and that for unity's sake, it would leave the white South to its own devices. In 1877, President Rutherford B. Hayes, in order to secure a compromise with Southern Democrats that would grant him the presidency in a contested election, agreed to pull federal troops from the South. With the troops gone, white Southerners quickly went about eradicating the gains of Reconstruction. The systemic white suppression of Black life was so severe that this period between the 1880s and the 1920s and 30s became known as the Great Nadir, or the second slavery. Democracy would not return to the South for nearly a century. White Southerners of all economic classes, on the other hand, thanks in significant part to the progressive policies and laws Black people had championed, experienced substantial improvement in their lives, even as they forced Black people back into quasi-slavery. As Waters McIntosh, who had been enslaved in South Carolina, lamented, "It was the poor white man who was freed by the war, not the Negroes."
That is a couple of stanzas from Lift Every Voice that has been called the Black National Anthem. This is Bill Resnick and Sharon Grant. Sharon reading from the Cole Hannah Jones essay, Our Democracy's Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black Americans Fought to Make Them True. So far in the essay, Nicole Hannah Jones has described the brief period after the Civil War when Black struggles won democratic constitutions and gains like public funding for education for all in the South, as well as on the national level winning crucial civil rights amendments, that is Amendments 13, 14, and 15 that have been used for making great gains for women, sexual minorities, other people of color, and the white working class. As to Blacks, however, the rise of white power led to Jim Crow segregation and murder in the South. Somewhat less thoroughly, segregation and police violence and being the last hired and first fired in the North. Nicole Hannah Jones discusses how the caste system was developed and maintained for near 100 years after white power crucified the Black freedom gained for a few years after the Civil War. Sharon Grant, Nicole Hannah Jones then describes the Black South and parts of the North in the period after that brief flowering of democracy in the United States, the re-enslavement of Blacks called Jim Crow.
Despite the guarantees of equality in the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court's landmark Plessy v. Ferguson decision in 1896 declared that the racial segregation of Black Americans was constitutional. With the blessing of the nation's highest court and no federal will to vindicate Black rights, starting in the late 1800s, Southern states passed a series of laws and codes meant to make slavery's racial caste system permanent by denying Black people political power, social equality, and basic dignity. They passed literacy tests to keep Black people from voting and created all-white primaries for elections. Black people were prohibited from serving on juries or testifying in court against a white person. Georgia made it illegal for Black and white people to be buried next to one another in the same cemetery. Alabama barred Black people from using public libraries that their own taxpayers were paying for. Black people were expected to jump off the sidewalk to let white people pass and call all white people by Miss or Mister, no matter how old they were. In the North, white politicians implemented policies that segregated Black people into slum neighborhoods and into all-Black schools, operated whites-only public pools, and held white and colored days at the country fair, and white businesses regularly denied Black people service, placing whites-only signs in their windows. States like California joined Southern states in barring Black people from marrying white people, while local school boards in Illinois and New Jersey mandated segregated schools for Black and white children. This caste system was maintained through wanton racial terrorism, and Black veterans, especially those with the audacity to wear their uniform, had, since the Civil War, been the target of a particular violence. This intensified during the two world wars because white people understood that once Black men had gone abroad and experienced life outside the suffocating racial oppression of America, they were unlikely to quietly return to their subjugation at home. As Senator James K. Vardaman of Mississippi said on the Senate floor during World War I, Black servicemen returning to the South would, quote, inevitably lead to disaster. Giving Black men military airs and sending him to defend the flag would bring him to the conclusion that his political rights must be respected, end quote. Many white Americans saw Black men in the uniforms of America's armed services not as patriotic, but as exhibiting a dangerous pride. Hundreds of Black veterans were beaten, maimed, shot, and lynched. During the height of racial terror in this country, Black Americans were not merely killed, but castrated, burned alive, and dismembered, with their body parts displayed in storefronts. This violence was meant to terrify and control Black people. Still, just as white Americans feared, World War II ignited what became Black Americans' second sustained mass movement for Black civil rights, the first being Reconstruction. As the centennial of slavery's end neared, Black people were still seeking the rights they had fought for and won after the Civil War. The right to be treated equally by public institutions, which was guaranteed in 1866 with the Civil Rights Act. The right to be treated as full citizens before the law, which was guaranteed in 1868 by the 14th Amendment. And the right to vote, which was guaranteed in 1870 by the 15th Amendment. In response to Black demands for these rights, white Americans strung them from trees, beat them, and dumped their bodies in muddy rivers, assassinated them in their front yards, firebombed them on buses, mauled them with dogs, peeled back their skin with fire hoses, and murdered their children with explosives set off inside a church. For the most part, Black Americans fought back alone, yet we never fought only for ourselves. The bloody freedom struggles of the civil rights movement laid the foundation for every other modern rights struggle. This nation's white founders set up a decidedly undemocratic constitution that excluded women, Native Americans, and Black people, and did not provide the vote or equality for most Americans. But the laws born out of Black resistance guarantee the franchise for all and ban discrimination based not just on race, but on gender, nationality, religion, and ability. No one cherishes freedom more than those who have not had it. And to this day, Black Americans, more than any other group, embrace the democratic ideals of a common good. We are the most likely to support programs like universal health care and a higher minimum wage, and to oppose programs that harm the most vulnerable. For instance, Black Americans suffer the most from violent crime, yet we are the most opposed to capital punishment. Our unemployment rate is nearly twice that of white Americans, yet we are still the most likely of all groups to say this nation should take in refugees. The truth is that as much democracy as this nation has today, it has been born on the backs of Black resistance. Our founding fathers may not have actually believed in the ideals they espoused, but Black people did. As one scholar, Joe R. Fagan, put it, quote, enslaved African Americans have been among the foremost freedom fighters this country has produced, end quote. For generations, we have believed in this country with a faith it did not deserve. Black people have seen the worst of America, yet somehow we still believe in its best.
To be sure, Sharon Grant, we are at the end of our presentation. I'm going to give you a brief break. Sharon Grant is our tireless reader of the essay by Nicole Hannah-Jones titled Our Founding Ideals Were False When They Were Written. Black America Fought to Make Them True. Through the essay that covers the Black experience for 400 years, from 20 slaves setting foot in 1619 in Jamestown, Virginia, all the way to today, Nicole Hannah-Jones does two things in the essay. For one, she chronicles that Black struggle to force America to live up to its ideals, that all humans have inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. For another, that U.S. liberty and democracy are a work in progress, And if you want to live free and democratic, you have to fight for it. Sharon Grant will now conclude the essay with Nicole Hannah-Jones, who at the end returned to her family's experience, to her father who worked hard but never got steady living wage work. Still, he proudly flew the American flag on their front lawn.
So Ms. Jones continues, "At 43, I'm part of the first generation of Black Americans in the history of the United States to be born into a society in which Black people had full rights of citizenship. Black people suffered under slavery for 250 years. We have been legally free for just 50. Yet in that briefest of spans, despite continuing to face rampant discrimination, and despite there never having been a genuine effort to redress the wrongs of slavery and the century of racial apartheid that followed, Black Americans have made astounding progress, not only for ourselves, but also for all Americans. What if America understood finally in this 400th year that we have never been the problem, but the solution? When I was a child, I must have been in fifth or sixth grade, a teacher gave our class an assignment intended to celebrate the diversity of the great American melting pot. She instructed each of us to write a short report on our ancestral land and then draw that nation's flag. As she turned to write the assignment on the board, the other Black girl in class looked locked eyes with me. Slavery had erased any connection we had to an African country, and even if we tried to claim the whole continent, there was no African flag. It was hard enough being one of two Black kids in the class, and this assignment would just be another reminder of the distance between the white kids and us. In the end, I walked over to the globe near my teacher's desk, picked a random African country, and claimed it as my own. I wish now that I could go back to the younger me and tell her that her people's ancestry started here, on these lands, and to boldly, proudly draw the stars and those stripes of the American flag. We were told once, by virtue of our bondage, that we could never be American. But it was by virtue of our bondage that we became the most American of all."
Sharon Grant, thank you.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
You're listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you, Bill Resnick and Sharon Grant, for that moving reading and summary of one of the important essays in the New York Times Magazine project called The 1619 Project, which is a great primer on Black history. You can read this online by just clicking on The 1619 Project, where you'll find the essay you heard today by Nicole Hannah-Jones and about a dozen other important contributions. We want to give special thanks to John Nelson for his expert editing of that piece. Now with us is Tracy Francis, director of the Cascade Festival of African Films. Hello, Tracy.
Hello.
Well, the Cascade Festival of African Films is in its 30th year, and it's a Portland institution that every year brings fantastic films by established and emerging African directors from over a dozen countries, and we're heading into the last week of the festival, which is a week focused on women filmmakers. Tell us about some of the films that will be featured this week.
Yeah, so we have a really exciting final week of the festival, and we're in our fifth week. And what's really exciting about this week is we have films from two countries that we've never shown films from at the festival, which are Libya and Eritrea. So on Thursday night, we have this amazing documentary from Libya that follows the women's soccer team there by a young, very young female filmmaker. And so I'm really excited about that. And I think it's just going to be a great access point for folks, especially in the soccer community here, just looking at their stories and their struggles through the revolution. It's shot over 5 years. And so you really kind of get embedded into their stories of these women and their struggles. And it's a beautiful film. And then our closing night film, we have a filmmaker coming to town. She's an Eritrean-American filmmaker. And the film is just a really joyous, wonderful film looking at the immigrant experience actually in the U.S. of the Eritrean community in San Francisco. So again, it's this great kind of cross-cultural celebration looking at what it's like to be an immigrant living here and how do you hold on to your culture if you're first generation or second generation.
And so what are the special contributions these women filmmakers make to the festival?
I mean, so the Women's Filmmaker Week is funny because it was started, and our festival is 30 years old, and so the Women's Filmmaker Week was started a while ago when there weren't as many women filmmakers who were, you know, who were getting to make films. And so now Women's Filmmaker Week is, we still have it as a way to really highlight and celebrate women filmmakers, but we have women filmmakers throughout our whole festival now because there's so many amazing filmmakers that they don't fit into a week. It's just wonderful. But this week is just really about really extra highlighting and making, you know, really promoting their work even more.
Well, what have been some of your favorite films so far in the festival?
Ooh, all of them. No. I think some of my favorite films that we've shown so far as our showcase film, Talking About Trees, which was a celebration of just the power of cinema, watching movies together, and looking at the cinema in Sudan. And our opening night film was also this amazing magical realism film from Ghana with a filmmaker here. But I would say, yeah, some of my favorite films are coming up this week. So the Libyan film, on Friday night, we have this great Algerian film called Papicha, looking at some of the issues in the 90s in Algeria and feminist issues of how dressing and fashion and just women's rights in Algeria and young people fighting for those rights. And so I think there's a lot of really important feminist issues coming up this week in the festival that I'm really excited to not only show the films, but I'm even more excited for the conversations that we're going to have after those films.
And I always find that, I mean, in addition to just seeing great films at the festival, just I learn so much about different places in Africa that we rarely hear about here. And so give us the specifics, Tracy Francis, about the remaining films to see this week. How can we find them? How can we find out more information about the series?
Yeah, I mean, the best place to go is our website, which is africanfilmfestival.org. And we are screenings this week start Wednesday. We have a special Wednesday series this year for our 30th, which are remastered films, mostly from the 60s and 70s, from the Film Foundation in California and the World Cinema Project. So on Wednesday, we have kind of a surrealist Romeo and Juliet tale from 1975 from Cameroon that's been fully remastered. Thursday night, we have the Libyan documentary about the soccer team. And we also have two matinees on Thursdays of our Friday and Saturday films if someone doesn't want to come out late at night. Then Friday night, we have Algeria. We have Papicha from Algeria. And Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. at PCC, we have a matinee of an Ethiopian film called Woven, which is another kind of cross-cultural family drama. And then Saturday night, we'll be at the Hollywood Theater again for closing night with our filmmaker for A Life is Fair.
So that's the Cascade Festival of African Films. Folks can find out the details about when and where. I mean, where are most of the films held? Are they
Every film will be at PCC Cascade in the Moriarty Building, which is on the corner of Albina and Killingsworth. Saturday night for closing night will be at the Hollywood Theater, and everything is completely free, but get there early to get a seat.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Tracy Francis, who is director of the Cascade Festival of African Films. And do get out, folks, to see some of these remaining films. As Tracy mentioned, Freedom Fields, the first film shown at the festival from Libya, and Life is Fair, the first Eritrean film to be shown at the festival, and lots of other good stuff that you can find out about on the Cascade Festival of African Films website. Thanks, Tracy.
All right, thank you so much.
Well, we want to thank everyone who's appeared on the show today, from Bill Resnick, Sharon Grant, Desiree Helligers, Melanie Plout, Tracy Francis, and special thanks to engineer Patricia Kohlberg and to John Nelson. As always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m. KBOO just had a successful winter pledge drive, but it was so short you may have missed it. So please go to the KBOO website and click on the red donate button to help support non-commercial community radio. And coming up next at 10 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Dan Serres of the Columbia Riverkeepers and Damon Moat's story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And at 11, it's First Voices Radio with Teoxin Ghost Horse.